they'd buy us a state-paid official.
And in a guardianship situation like you have in your bill for a restrictive guardianship provision, there is no... there's a provision requiring the appointment of counsel, is there not?
There's no provision requiring appointment of counsel.
In the bill, in the bill you're proposing? Does the court shall
appoint an attorney? As proposed, there is a provision. Whether it's mandatory is a question, because it's subject to the discretion of the court in determining whether the interests of justice require the appointment.
So what we're saying is, in a situation where there is a guardianship and someone is going to be put in restrictive custody, it's discretionary with the court. However, where it's someone to be committed civilly, there's no discretion with the court. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct.
And yet in both positions, the person's liberty is being being
yes,
hemmed in.
Okay. Thank you very much. Scott McGraw. Judge Johnson, you want to say anything about this eventually?
Yes, I got here late. I didn't get my name on it.
Good. Well, what, you want to come up now? Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, Senators, Councilman Taylor, my name is Scott McGraw. I am here on behalf of the firm of which I'm a partner, which is the local law firm of Pounder, Zinsky & McGraw. One of my partners, Larry Pound, has testified before you in the past on not this measure, but on related measures that have been before this session. And I would like to begin my comments today by addressing a couple of issues that Councilman Taylor rose a moment ago. With regard to the appointment of counsel in a civil commitment proceeding, typically a civil commitment proceeding comes in most cases when there is no one else to seek a commitment of an individual, and because of state action which you have recognized, there must be an appointment of counsel. In instances where there are interested persons, typically family members, but not in all cases family members, where some form of assistance is required, a civil guardianship proceeding is the manner, or is the method or system that is used. We have an inherently flexible guardianship and conservatorship system in our state. Inherent in a flexible system is also the possibility of abuse, which has occurred apparently in the Grant v. Johnson case, at least as interpreted by Judge Fry in the Federal District Court. I have been part of the work group within the Family Justice Subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee that has gotten to the point where A.N. Gross, House Bill 2708, has reached this committee. I would address the point that the portions of A.N. Gross 2708 that deal with the appointment of counsel and payment of fees is the portion of this bill that has not received appropriate or significant discussion prior to reaching you. Grant v. Johnson, in our opinion, requires the notice and opportunity to be heard by a prospective ward in situations of a temporary guardianship, and A.N. Gross 2708 addresses that appropriately. And perhaps I should back up for a moment and explain by what authority I speak. I'm part of a specialty law firm, or I should say a law firm that emphasizes a very narrow area of the practice of law. We are an informal public guardian and conservator for primarily four counties in the Willamette Valley. Approximately 80% of our practice is related to probate, guardianship, and conservatorship work, and a full 50% of our practice is involving cases where we act as the fiduciary. We receive case referrals from courts in primarily problem fiduciary cases. We receive referrals from banks where there are insufficient funds or overwhelming problems that makes it not of interest. We receive case referrals from some individuals, and we receive case referrals from state agencies in a variety of cases. We do a tremendous amount of this work. I think we probably do more work of this nature than as a firm than any other firm in the state. There are legal services groups that involve themselves in this area, but as a private practicing firm, I think we probably do more than anybody else does. Less than 1% of guardianships and temporary guardianships in our experience are presently contested. less than 1%. The issue in temporary guardianships of notice and opportunity to be heard are significant issues that should be addressed by statute and are not. In the administrative practice of various counsel who do it right, notice is provided, but as Grant V. Johnson points out, it's not required. And that part of A in Gross 2708 should pass through this committee. It's an appropriate compromise. It provides prompt notice and an opportunity to be heard. That's as far as Grant V. Johnson goes. We don't need to take one step farther than that. In fact, we probably should not for a couple of different reasons. We have submitted, at the request of various individuals, to the State Bar through appropriate channels, a complete revision draft of Oregon Chapter 126 as it relates to guardianships and conservatorships. That has not reached the bar in time to be, you know, dealt with at this legislative session. We have drafted it recently, and I do mean recently in that we did it a couple, 3 months ago. We killed a lot of trees in the process. But that draft considers a comprehensive relook at a number of areas, including temporary guardianships. When we are going to the issue of appointment of counsel and payment for that, we have to look more than just in the area of temporary guardianships. Special conservatorships come to mind as to how it should be applicable in those cases. What we should be doing here is dealing with the most clear need, which is notice and opportunity to be heard. Beyond that, we should be taking this as a comprehensive rewrite, which has been admittedly necessary by various members and key members of the bar for several years, and for various reasons, it has never been successfully completed.
Okay, let me stop you then by saying, okay, let's assume we leave the you're testifying basically in opposition to parts of the bill, I'm assuming, and suggesting that we leave the council issue on the table. What happens then?
In our experience, no individual opposing a guardianship or a conservatorship has ever been required to proceed before the court without counsel. Oregon Chapter Revised Statutes Chapter 126 has a discretionary provision in it where the court may appoint counsel for an individual. We believe that section of the statutes is sufficient to meet the needs of any individual under a guardianship or conservatorship proceeding. What our particular concern with A in Gross 2708 is, as it's written, we have the opposite belief of advocacy center that where justice requires and there will be a restrictive placement, then the court has to appoint counsel. To meet process needs, we think justice would require the appointment in every single case. And as we see less than 1% of cases being opposed, we find that that would be a very strong fee generation mechanism for whether it be private practitioners or legal services agencies or whatever. We see that as a strong fee-generating proposal that will cripple the system. If, as set forth in the proposed amendments, an order appointing a temporary guardian is a judgment for purposes of ORS 19.010, then a general notice of appeal to any appointment of a temporary guardian or guardian would belay the authority of that temporary guardian or guardian until the case was heard on appeal. And we believe that that is inappropriate because that will cripple the system. The system is based on humanity, and humanity is not based on the system. To accomplish that, it has to be flexible, and it has to allow people to go forth in their best faith. It is possible to create abuses. That is clear. At the same time, when an individual has objected, we have never experienced a case where they have been forced to proceed without some level of assistance of counsel. Placing the burden for paying for this counsel, as set forth in here on a petitioner, will place sufficient additional burdens on either family members, who are the typical ones to bring these cases forth, or state agencies, or private attorneys such as ourselves who are taking cases up because there does not appear to be anyone else available. It will place enough burdens on the petitioner portion of the system that, as one counsel has stated, one attorney I know has stated and who is not available to be here today, The family will say, well, I have paid for my lawyer to get this going. And in Portland, I pay $300 for the visitor. And I pay the costs of the court to get the case going. And now I'm going to pay some reasonable fee for an attorney to come forth. I think the bus is going to hit Grandma. And that's the bottom line. It is going to place enough of a chilling effect on the system as to effectively cripple it, which is not in the best interest of anyone. There is also an issue that comes to mind, in that we are involved in setting up a petitioning procedure within our statutes for individuals who are at the state hospital here in town. One of the problems that the Advocacy Center, I think, would agree is that there is an issue of privacy and non-disclosure of certain types of records of those individuals. There is a procedure within Oregon Revised Statutes outside of Chapter 126 for the district attorney of a county, to bring forth by petition and get an order of the court to disclose those records so that appropriate action can be taken. Now, if the district attorney is going to be told that to accomplish this, he's going to have to pay for the other side's attorney as well, I think that's going to cause even more problems. Those cases are going to be more the exception to the rule in guardianships, but I just want you to realize that from an entire perspective in the system, it won't work. It simply will not work.
Even if you're dealing with less than 1% of the cases being contested, you're saying this is going to, in the interest of justice, there are going to be more.
There will probably be more contested cases, whether it be by advocates hanging around the hospitals or hanging around the courthouse to find out where cases are filed. We believe that it will create enough of a fee-generating interest that we will see a marked increase in contested cases. And I guess what I would also like to point out is that while we have experienced a less than 1% contest rate in the guardianships and conservatorships that we are involved in, our firm, and in my own personal experience, which surveys the last approximately 10 years, and progressively so for the last 7 years, I don't believe I've ever been involved in a case where the court denied the appointment of a guardian or a conservator. It does happen on occasion, but the point I'm making is it is the extreme exception to the rule that the appointment is denied.
Okay, thank you. Other question? Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm the Johnson in Grant versus Johnson.
We thought that might be.
But let me state first, I don't have, as to Judge Fry's basic decision, which was that the statute was deficient because there was no provision for notice and insurance of a hearing. And when it was brought to my attention, we immediately adopted rules and fully agree with that concept, rules that are pretty much consistent with what you've got here. 2708. There have been some representations about Grant versus Johnson, which I think ought to be corrected. I doubt very much that the protected person in that case was really seriously injured. She was placed in Providence Hospital. Remember, the guardian, the petitioner, was her husband, who apparently was contemplating divorce, but he was petitioning to have her mother appointed as the guardian. She was the guardian. She was placed in Providence Hospital for 2 weeks and released, and then they withdrew any further proceedings. Now, there have been some previous statements made. If Mrs. Grant was placed in that hospital and didn't need to be placed in that hospital, I can assure you that there is a tremendous amount of liability on the part of the guardian, Because the guardian, unlike a mental commitment proceeding, the guardian is a fiduciary. And a fiduciary has all kinds of obligations, and failure to carry out those obligations subjects them to suit. Likewise, anybody who would think that a private hospital like Providence Hospital would take a patient in and hold that patient there, they didn't think that patient was sick, you know, you're not living in the modern age of litigation. I could get you a courtroom full of lawyers anytime you want who would be glad to take that case. I think there's been some things that are, statements made here that I don't think conform with the realities. Granting a temporary guardianship so somebody can get some dental care, I have never heard of that kind of a temporary guardianship. If anybody came to me with a petition, and let me say, I am the probate judge in Multnomah County, that is not grounds for a temporary guardianship. There's no emergency there that I can see. Some recitation about that we grant guardianships without evidence. Anytime we grant a temporary guardianship, the lawyer has to come to the court and he makes a presentation to me. And if we're not satisfied that a temporary guardianship is in order, we're not going to grant it. The whole concept that you want to, that we need to have counsel for these people, particularly the way we've got this bill drafted now, it just seems to me there are cases where counsel might be desirable, and I have appointed counsel. A lot of times we look to the protected person themselves, their own assets. They'll set up a conservatorship and it's paid for out of there. You know, it is expensive just to get a guardianship today. It requires a lawyer. And then to have to hire another lawyer, I think a lot of people are going to just say, well, what is this, a full crew law for lawyers? Or are we trying to help people who are generally, 99% of the time, are very sick? The typical temporary guardianship is somebody who is suffering from either a mental or a physical illness, and they need somebody to make health care decisions for them. And they're usually, the petitioners are members of the family. If they aren't members of the family, they're somebody who usually is on a very humanitarian, has a very humanitarian objective. And to simply automatically interject in more lawyers, I do not think is going to solve the problem. I just don't think it's necessary. The one thing I have, the bill as drafted, I think is in good shape. And it was a committee that was appointed under Representative Mannix, and we agreed on everything. And then this provision on attorney's fees being paid by the petitioning party snuck in during the committee deliberation. I would hope you'd seriously consider removing that. Let me say this. I speak here for myself, but I have talked to the Oregon State Bar Committee on probate, and I believe their position is the same as mine. Let me put it in practical terms. The way this bill will work, the one thing we're concerned about is not Multnomah County, because we have 3 full-time visitors, and so they're readily available to cover that. I am worried about some of the downstate jurisdictions that don't have those kind of resources, but apparently nobody's raised a serious objection on this point, so we think this is fine. But the point is this. Somebody petitions for a temporary guardianship. We appoint a visitor to go out there and interview that person right away. If that person can indicate to the visitor or some way to me that they know what date of the month it is, or, you know, what month of the year it is. They have some idea what time of day it is and where they are. It is very unlikely that there's going to be any temporary guardianship. And that's just the practical matter. And you're talking about people who are really sick and cannot go that far. But as soon as somebody comes into court and says they want a hearing, and the fact that they're able to articulate that they want a hearing is generally grounds right there, you're going to deny any petition. Let me say one other thing. This bill talks about a restrictive placement. It's a very naive notion. A guardianship is, by its nature, a deprivation of liberty, because you are transferring responsibility for making health care decisions to somebody else. And whether you put them into a hospital, some kind of a rest home, or somewhere else, you're restricting their liberty. But oftentimes, at the time of the petition, I don't know where they're going to place them, nor does the proposed guardian. They are in here because they've got some member of the family who is out walking the streets at night without their clothes on. And they say, gee, we've got to get control of this person. So we don't always know when a restrictive placement, so to speak, is going to be made. And frankly, I just have a hard time distinguishing between a guardianship is a restriction of liberty. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Lee, could you give us some idea how that visitor system works and how it would work under the time constraints of this bill? Can the visitors act quickly enough to report back to the court before you? Will they routinely do that? Do you see that as a...
I have three persons that are visitors. We kind of revised our whole visitor program about a year ago in Multnomah County. I used to have a big, long list of them. And we went through a very careful interview.
And you also had Judge McClennan who didn't want to ever appoint a visitor.
Right.
We fussed with him for a long time.
Well, the visitor, to me, is my... That's the advocate to make sure that somebody isn't overreaching.
And you're required to appoint a visitor, if I read this.
And the way this bill, the thing this bill does is it says that within 48 hours, that visitor gets out and at least interviews the...
Is that in here, the 48-hour business?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's probably the key provision. I have to be very candid. It's not going to be. I've talked over with our visitors. That'll be no problem. It will be some problem down state. Frankly, because one of the reasons is we charge the parties. We do charge them $300 to the visitor, and some jurisdictions are using volunteers.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Thanks very much for coming. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anyone else to speak to House Bill 2708?
Madam Chairman, might I speak to it?
Quickly. Your name for the record.
I'm Ralph Wyckoff. I live at 2844 Ridgeway Drive, Turner, Oregon. I presently hold a pro tem appointment as Circuit Judge for Marion County. I have exercised that office for the last year. I am assigned regularly to the probate, guardianship, conservatorship matters that come before the court in Marion County.
Right.
My jurisdiction is not exclusive with the other judges. I would like to speak to just one issue, and that is the matter of attorney's fees. I think we all recognize that the purpose of this statute is to protect elderly persons from having unneeded guardians forced upon them that will force them to go into a restrictive environment.
I think we need to look at the real world to understand that there are people who intercede, neighbors and others, with regard to people who are of diminished mentality. I think we also need to recognize that the protection afforded by the conservatorship laws are not completely adequate. We have situations which, as a pattern, arise in which neighbors, friends, not quite so close relatives, get themselves made beneficiaries of a person's estate. When that happens, that person, who is usually, as I say, a neighbor or somebody living close to an infirm person, obtains control to the extent of their activities. Since they are the beneficiaries of their estate, their interest is not to spend any more of that estate as possible. They also have, sometimes I have concerns with regard to that an infirm person's individual safety. Many infirm people don't recognize the smell of gas. Many of those people are not a bit of hesitant about leaving burners going on the stove. There are people who probably properly should not be in the home. When a closer relative intercedes and tries to have a guardian appointed, they run the obligation of paying for their own lawyer. They run the obligation of having to pay for a visitor, which can be anywhere from $75 to $500. They now have thrust upon them the possibility of having this resisted and having to pay for yet a further lawyer. In effect, it gives, let's say, this, quote, friendly neighbor a chance to have a free representation as they try to retain the advantage they have over the infirm person. I think the provision in here would require a petitioner to pay for a lawyer has an undue chilling effect. I certainly would agree that everybody who forces a restriction should have a lawyer if the situation is challenged. But under the circumstances of this case, I think this is extremely unwise. Well, I might have been more elaborate if I'd had more time. But I want to make this point very clear. I can comment from my experience in Marion County on anything else you might want to ask me.
Thank you. Are there questions, Mr. Wycliffe? Thank you. We've worked with you before. We know how to get hold of you, I think, Bill does. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for coming. Anyone else? House Bill 2708. Thank you very much. Let's move to House Bill 2996. Tony Peterson is here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tony Peterson, Assistant Administrator, Children's Services Division. And I'm here today to testify in support of A. Engrossed House Bill 2996. This bill deals with two common problems in independent adoptions: the lack of representation of birth parents, and asking judges to make decisions with no information about the adoptive family. First, judges are often asked to make decisions about temporary guardianship of a child before the judge gets any information about the family. Section 1, subsection 2A, D, allows the attorney to file the report of an adoption agency along with the petition. This would give the judge immediate information about the petitioners and help the judge determine if temporary guardianship is appropriate pending the outcome of the adoption proceedings. Second, House Bill 2996A requires that people consenting to adoption be given an impartial explanation of the consequences of signing the Certificate of Irrevocability and Waiver of Appearance in Court. Under this bill, the explanation could no longer be given by the petitioner's attorney. the explanation would be given impartially by the Children's Services Division, a licensed adoption agency, or by another attorney. This change provides better protection for the birth parents' rights. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else to speak to House Bill 2996? Thank you. We'll hold this over. Make sure that interested public parties or whomever might have a chance to come forward if they didn't have appropriate notice today. And let's move to House Bill 2381. Mr. Barton.
Madam Chair, Drill Meyer Barton from Portland, Oregon, representing the International Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. This bill was quite seriously debated and worked out to satisfy all the problems of the Court Administrator's Office in the House. I'd like to start off with saying what this bill does not do, and it does not replace our existing arbitration, conciliation, and mediation program adopted a few years ago, and also a pilot project in Portland for a couple of years. This is a supplement to it. This model law